Hi, Smart Community friends. I'm back with another bonus episode of the Smart Community Podcast, sharing various guests' answers to the question, where to next for smart cities and communities? And this time, I'm sharing with you the answers from these guests. Jacqueline Nagel from episode 247, David Jacobs from 246, Michael Healy from 244, and finally, Dr. Kelly Turner from episode 245. Some themes that come through in the guest answers are around the current population shift for regional communities, better collaboration and integration, interconnectedness, and a more human-centric focus in communities. The opportunities now for our regional communities to embrace the smart community concept is growing, and the learnings from COVID have shown us that work is no longer as location-dependent and topics are not as geographically constrained. We have more resources available through technology and digital integration, which gives us the ability to share knowledge on a global scale and opens many doors for better collaboration. Our interactions now do not have to either be digital or physical, but our interactions should be specific. As Jacqueline Nagel says, wherever you are right now needs to be intentional and deliberate, and that's one thing I hope we don't lose. We have to get rid of the either or, one or the other. And this is what being smart is all about. Wherever we are, we need to be deliberate and intentional about it. So those guests again, Jacqueline Nagel, David Jacobs, Michael Healy, and finally, Dr. Kelly Turner. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play. With smart communities, the future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Where to next for smart communities?
I think the shift that we have in our population to regional centres is giving an extraordinary opportunity for regional communities to embrace smart.
Yep, I agree. I concur. I think that's a really key point and something I get asked to talk about, right? Because it's, okay, there's affordable housing, there's land use, there's all these things, there's how do we have the quality of life that we have in regional towns without the messiness of cities. And that's going to be really key. Technology and data are going to play a huge part in that. But we need to start thinking about these things now, because even if it isn't as massive as they say it is, I think it will be definitely something that is key. And the research is showing that, right? The research is showing that people want to be moving out. And whether they come back and move here or there, I mean, I'm an example of that, I suppose. But yeah, it will be really interesting.
Well, the understanding, as you know, my partner moved up from Canberra during COVID. And the reason why he was able to is before that, where his main source of business activity was from, it was seen that he had to be in that location, which was Canberra, right? So defence was seen as being in Canberra. Now, prior to COVID, he couldn't have moved away from Canberra without losing a great deal of his business base. But with the learnings from that, it's no longer a challenge or an issue, and he can be located anywhere as long as he can get to Canberra.
You are absolutely right, and I missed that point. It's like we are location independent, which is something we've talked about a lot, and I've talked about on the podcast as well. So it's not just like people are trying to get out of cities to be away from the COVID and the lockdowns. It's actually that we realize, and it has been acknowledged, because we've realized many a year ago, right? But it's been acknowledged and it's normalized that the information that we have is not location dependent. It's independent. Whereas before it was like, oh, that's great. You're in Queensland. We're doing a strategy down in New South Wales. If you don't come down here, you don't care as much or something like that, whatever the thinking was. And even internationally, right? It's like, oh, that's great, but you're in Australia and it'll be too hard. It'll be way too hard to do this.
I was actually having a conversation with a client today who is a speaker, a professional speaker, and had actually started doing face-to-face again in this last few months. And then, of course, we've been thrown into chaos again. And a lot of events have been cancelled. So they've either shifted online or they've been cancelled altogether. And I was talking to her and I said, but you have a topic that is global. We don't actually have to sit here in Australia. And I talked to her about the example of another client who you and I both know, Zoe, who is actually delivering two or three times in any one day now around the world, right? Because topic is not geographically constrained. And so all of a sudden she's actually pitching to conferences in the US, and she's pitching to organizations that have their headquarters in London, and she's doing stuff in Australia, and she's built this business out of Melbourne, which has had the biggest lockdown periods of any of us. And she's been able to actually expand it globally and get work from places that she wouldn't have even considered before. And that's what I had to say to this other client today. I used that example and I said, your playground is no longer Sydney. Your playground is wherever they will let you come in virtually.
Exactly. And I think like COVID has been able to legitimize.
I think legitimize is pretty close.
Yeah, that our knowledge is still the same, whether we're there physically or virtually. And I think that's really key. What I would say is that for me, I mean, I can operate digitally all day, every day, but I miss the face-to-face. It doesn't mean that the virtual is less important. It just means that I really value then, okay, well, I'm not just going to accidentally, you know, commute to Brisbane. It's I'm going to go to Brisbane. I'm going to meet with this person, and I'm going to build a human connection. It's not just going to be, oh, there's some meeting or whatever. It's like, I'm going to, you know, socialize, all those things. And for me, commute to Brisbane now isn't a hard thing to do. Whereas before it was a little bit hard because I was like, oh, I have to go there. Whereas now it's like, yeah.
I think it's made what we do deliberate and intentional. Like if we're going to get on a plane or if we're going to drive for a few hours, then we're actually now deliberate and intentional, whereas it had just become part of our life. Like, you know, as you know, when I was launching my previous business into the US, I thought nothing of jumping on a plane, flying to Phoenix, delivering a three-day workshop and flying back 2 days later, like a 5 to 6 day turnaround just to deliver a workshop. We didn't think twice about it, you know, and I think what I love now is everything is more deliberate and intentional for the face-to-face. And it's interesting because many of us who are educators are actually finding stronger results when we deliver virtually well, right? And we think it's because we've got everyone captured. Like attentions are captured really strongly. So if you're really good at virtual delivery in the education space, your outcomes are actually increasing through virtual. But nothing will ever take away that craving we have, that hardwiring we have to be connected and in the same space ever.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's fine. I don't think, like, you know, seen articles about working in the office and working from home and, you know, what do we do? But it's like black and white, like as if it's one or the other. It's not.
Not an either or anymore, you know. It will be flexible. It might be that, you know, meetings are held in the office or get-togethers or whatever. But again, it's about wherever you are, it's got to be intentional and deliberate. So it should not be we have to all be back in the office because it's a 40-hour week and that's what we've done since the Industrial Revolution. It now has to be we're going to bring our people together for this purpose, and this purpose. And those are the only three or four reasons that we're going together, right? So again, it's wherever you are, it now needs to be intentional and deliberate. And that's actually the one thing I hope we don't lose is this, we have to get rid of the either or, one or the other. And this is what being smart is all about. And wherever we are, we need to be deliberate and intentional about it.
So where to next for smart communities?
Well, I would say the smart communities need to bring in expertise from various different sources. Use the resources available. Don't just think, if I put this hardware and this software here, it's going to work. It's not. You have to stop disregarding the human being. And that is where everybody is moving towards. It's not about the human. It's about just creating something that's easier to use. User confidence is starting to be grown over by telling them, this is good, this is good. And it's not that good. You need to ensure that you do it right. Smart communities in our country, they're already talking about it. They want to do one year close to us, but it's only going to work if you do it right, using the right resources and placing the human at the center point. That's how I see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I think in this space, it's so multidisciplinary as well, right? So it's not even like exactly what you said, you need the right resources and you need the right skill sets within there. So then you've got the expertise because not everyone is going to, you know, you can't just hire one person that's going to be able to do everything because there's so many different You know, it's like you don't hire one person to build a city, right? Like, and so it's the same with smart communities. There are so many different aspects to it. You need to make sure that all those things are covered.
I agree. I think that if you are thinking that, listen, I'm going to contact this consulting firm because they're a big consulting firm. They work for all these companies and they've got a good resume and all that. And I'm going to use them to consult on, say, identity management space. What do they know about? Remember, an identity is evidence of the existence of a real-world human being. That's what an identity is. They haven't got that in their, let's say, their spectrum. It's not their, where they're working with. They only look at processes and hardware and software, and they believe that's going to work. So rather bring in somebody that knows, or an institution or government institution, build it, that you've got people in this space that knows everything about it. And then you need to flex this to all the different divisions, all the different builders of the city, exactly like you said there. There's such a lot of different facets.
So where to next for smart communities?
And again, that's quite a hard question. I suppose everyone would have a different opinion potentially. But I don't think it's that complex, really. I think it's about the need to talk more and interact more across different councils, with government, with private industry, with startups. And in thinking of the different parts of an innovation community, I think one of the key opportunities is to make it a lot more joined up and to collaborate more. So I think, yeah, for us, it'll be about getting more connected, more collaborative, operationalizing or realizing that potential we've been talking about for a few years, becoming that core function, but also working, yeah, on strategic relationships. Like we've got our economic office here that we work really closely with. They've got something called a supernode program, which is four areas of opportunity for the economy here, agri-tech and aerospace being two of those four. And we work really closely with them to either, you know, help share opportunities or local issues with local innovators and see if we can support them to come up with world-first solutions. And we work with our holding company that owns our port and the airport and a big maintenance company, and talking about what are the things we can do to leverage our collective expertise and ingenuity. We've got a really cool project called Te Whariki, which means woven mat in Māori, which basically, staff from right across that group, that includes the airport and the port and the maintenance companies, can log their details, put their interests, their expertise and experience, and then anyone from across that wider group can put in opportunities for them. And it could be a full-time job, it could be a one-off workshop, it could be just a two-hour redesign of a web page. But a really good example about how to kind of leverage your collective human potential and really engage staff as well and open up a world of possibilities that weren't there previously. So we're thinking about, again, with sustainability across a big group of companies like that, we're all trying to do the same thing in terms of reducing carbon emissions. So what are the things we can do collectively to really make a bigger difference, but also just be a bit smarter about the way we approach things?
Yeah, and it's so powerful. And I think we underestimate that power. And I think I was talking to somebody yesterday about this. It's like all these big things, big projects, big, I don't know, even events and things all started with an idea from a person, right? Looking at, oh, there's this problem here. How can I solve that? Or there's an opportunity here. How can I leverage that? And then it starts with that, and then more and more conversations happen. And then it only happens when there's that real collaboration. Because we can't do it by ourselves. It's, you know, the idea is brilliant, but if you can't execute on it with other people, then it's not very useful.
You're completely right. And that's, I suppose, and you learn with experience, you know, you think you can achieve things on your own and you're wide of the mark. Because there's an old motto from continuous improvement, which is success is quality of solution times acceptance. So you may have the best solution in your head, but if you can't sell it or get people to jump on board, then it'll never take off.
Where to next for smart communities?
Well, it will be interesting to see how the cell phone mobility study pilot pans out and where people are going. I think cities can think about heat as this dynamic type of event. I think the next thing is definitely governance. I think it should come from the federal level, since One of the reasons why I think it should come at the federal level, as well as cities doing their own stuff, is that when you start talking about things like development and real estate development, then you get into issues of competition too. So I would like to see also a federal signal. You know, another thing is acknowledging, I know this doesn't sound future-y, but something that we haven't really acknowledged is that, you know, cities are hot because we built them that way, and we built them hotter and cooler in really inequitable ways. So one of my favorite data products is this, the redlining and heat maps, which was a study based by Hoffman et al., and it was highlighted in the New York Times. And you can go online and you can play around with it, at least for the United States, and you can see very clearly that places where our homeowners loan corporation in the 1920s and 30s explicitly racially would not, you know, let certain communities buy houses. And so you can see that those sort of racial inequities that were embedded in the system then track onto things like vegetation, track onto things like current heat disparities. So in some ways, we need to really take stock of not just these indicators of things like redlining tracking on today, but why? Why did that lead through the time? So I'm working with a historian, one of the projects I'm most excited about. I'm working with a historian and an anthropologist, and we're going to go into Watts and look at aerial photos and digitize them and try to tell a story of, you know, how did we produce a hot condition in the community of Watts over the last 50 years, 70 years? And what are sort of the policies and land use decisions that not just explicitly, but implicitly were guided by race? And I think if we have a better understanding of how we created such gross inequities, then we'll get to a better place of correcting them.
Wow, that sounds so interesting. And yeah, I look forward to seeing some of the results from that. I think we sometimes, until we do something like that or look at things like that, we forget how interconnected everything is, right? It's all connected. But looking at the what, yeah, why, like what and why is this the reason? And then, yeah, understanding that then can help us then to fix that issue or work towards a solution. So, yeah.
The Smart Community Podcast is brought to you by My Smart Community. If you're trying to deal with disruption, not sure what technologies to buy, need to facilitate genuine collaboration, then we can help. Email hello@mysmart.community or head to www.mysmart.community/consulting.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.